This is Mark Gilbert. I'm talking to Billy Lee Langley. It's September 7th, 1997. We're at Hermosa Beach at the home of June Pulcini, and we're going to talk about the IVS experience in Indochina. What I'd like to do is ask you some preliminary questions, such as, for example, when were you born?
1939.
And you were born in?
June. Denver, Colorado.
Denver, Colorado. Good. And did you go to high school in Denver?
No. In 1951, we moved to California, and I started junior high in California, and then went to high school in Gardena, California, and Hawthorne, California, which is near Los Angeles, a suburb. And then my last 2 years of high school, I went to school in Europe, in Switzerland, Lutry, Switzerland.
Your parents traveled?
My father was living in Saudi Arabia. Uh-huh. So
because?
He was working with Aramco.
Aramco?
Mm-hmm, in industrial relations.
And why did you move to Switzerland?
Well, because I went to live with my father.
Uh-huh.
And so I'm from a divorced family, mm-hmm. so I went to live with my father. And the schools only went up to the ninth grade in Saudi Arabia. And so they sent us to high school wherever we chose. And I decided to go to Switzerland.
Mm. And what were your religious affiliation of your parents?
My father's Episcopalian, and my mother was a Presbyterian or Methodist, depending on the situation.
Normally what I ask now is, did you have any inkling you would ever do anything in terms of international work when you were young?
When I was little, no, except that my father was in the Navy and had traveled a great deal, so I was always interested in the world. And when he came back and told us stories about different places, I was interested. I've always wanted to travel, so it wasn't a case of dreaming of living in another country. It was just I loved people and I loved other countries. And mm-hmm. geography, when I was in elementary school, was an important topic for me in school. Mm-hmm. So, no, I never had any big dream of going out and living in another place, in another country.
But you ended up doing that anyway when you were in high school.
High school in California was not an exciting experience for me. And it was very boring and very dull, and education was always, I loved school and I just wasn't doing really well in high school, which isn't unusual for teenagers. And so when my father came and said that I could go to Saudi Arabia for the summer, and while I was there, we discussed my living there and going to Europe to school. It just seemed like a wonderful opportunity, really mainly for education. I wasn't thinking of it in terms of, living abroad or something like mm-hmm. that. It was really furthering my education, and having firsthand experiences is just important to me. Mm-hmm.
And when you finished your schooling in Switzerland, what did you do then?
Then I went to a private college in upstate New York, Elmira College. Mm-hmm. It's a girls' college. And I decided, because my school in Switzerland was so small, and there were 16 girls in school, and it was a girls' school, it was a finishing school. And so when I decided to go to college, I really wanted a small college, and I really enjoyed going to girls' schools at that point, mainly because I was so interested in studying, and I felt like I could focus better. Elmira's next to Ithaca and Cornell, so we never had any trouble of co-ed education or whatever being around. But I was really pleased that I had that chance to choose this college, and my father could afford it. I was really aware of how expensive something like that was, and I appreciated getting to have that opportunity. So,
where did you first hear about IVS?
was getting ready to finish at Elmira, and while I was at Elmira, I used to go back and forth to Saudi Arabia every summer. And when I was in my junior year of college, we worked in the summer in Saudi Arabia. That was one of the things we could do. And I got my first job teaching ESL to Saudi engineers. So I knew that I really enjoyed teaching ESL, and my major in college was international relations. And I had done job interviews in the State Department, et cetera, and they would smile at me and tell me, well, I could be a very good secretary at such and such office. And with my education and my background, and I spoke French and I'd lived so many places, I really felt that that wasn't taking advantage of my education. So after going through the State Department and actually having ties and people that knew I had friends, and they still were only offering me jobs as a secretary, and the United Nations as well, I decided, well, you know, I love teaching ESL. I think I'm going to look around and see what's available. And that was when the Peace Corps first began. And my investigation of the Peace Corps indicated it was so large. And again, because I was so used to small school, girls' school, and I liked the intimate environment of a small school, I knew that I wouldn't be as successful in the Peace Corps as I looked as a career. So I interviewed people, and one day there was this magazine about international jobs, and IVS had an ad in this magazine. And so one of my minors in college was Black History, and I'd wanted to go to Africa. So they had an opening in Africa. So I applied with IVS, and yes, they were interested, and especially since I had this ESL experience, even though it was very limited for a summer job, they were interested in me, and my major was international relations. So we wrote our second letter, at which time they discovered that I wasn't male. They'd made a gross error, just like when I applied for college, Michigan offered me a football scholarship. So I received this letter indicating that they couldn't accept my application in Africa because I was a single woman, but that they were opening an education team, their first education team position in Vietnam. Would I be interested in going to Vietnam? And I was at the point of really wanting to do something creative and also volunteering. That idea really sounded good to me. And so I thought, well, you know, this isn't Africa. I'm not going to use my background. I'm not going to get to do what I want. But gee, Vietnam sounds interesting. And so I talked with my dad. He'd been to Vietnam in the early 50s, and he loved Saigon. And I said, well, you know, I'm thinking about working there. And he thought it sounded like a good idea, too. And so I wrote IVS, and I said, yes, I could consider Vietnam instead of Africa. And I was very much interested in education, and I'd be glad to be a part of their first team. So that's a long answer, but that's how I ended up in Vietnam with IVS. And immediately when they said yes, they had accepted me as an applicant for the team, I went up to Cornell to see about the Vietnamese language. And this is in 1962, and there was next to nothing about Vietnamese language in Cornell Library. So I was very pleased that IVS was going to give us our orientation in country, and that I'd have an opportunity to learn about the culture and the language before I was placed as a teacher.
You taught, how often had you taught ESL?
Before I joined IVS, only that one summer.
One summer.
It was a real interesting experience because in Saudi Arabia, women were still and still are in purdom. And so here I was, a woman teaching these engineers, Saudi engineers. So I had a lot of challenges when I taught that summer. So even though it was short, I really felt that it was a good beginning. And I was intrepid, too, about IVS because it was an education team. And while I was in college, I first started out as a statistician mathematician. That was my major. And then I recognized the limitations for women in the early 50s and late 50s in that field. So I decided, okay, I'll go into education. And the department head in education at my college told me that I should not be a teacher, that I would not be a good teacher. So I shifted from education into international relations. So I was a little intrepid about going to Vietnam as a teacher after having all those other experiences.
Hmm. Why do you think he advised you that
way? Because I wrote a paper about mediocre professors, and he took it as a personal insult.
So there was a reason.
Yes.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yes.
And when you, tell me about how you, after you wrote the letters and they said you were accepted, what happened then? How did you meet Forrest?
Then I was able to go to Washington, D.C., and I had this wonderful interview with Dr. Stevenson, who just really convinced me that this was an excellent opportunity.
Dr. Stevenson was?
The head of IBS at the time, the director of IBS. Mm-hmm. And he was just such a warm, caring person. And also, he spoke to me as an educated person. I didn't have any of this down talking or whatever, so I was really impressed with IBS and interviewing with him. So that was it. We got our, they sent us, I went back to Colorado, that was where my dad was at that time, and I went to Colorado and I got a letter and it told me that I was leaving for Vietnam within, I think it was like 9 days. And we were meeting, all of us that were going over with the education team were meeting in San Francisco for a couple of days. And that's where I met all the Forrest and Betty Gao. And
That's Forrest Gerdes.
Yeah,
Forrest Gerdes.
Yes, And Wright. And Wright was, there were three women there in the, and that was a little unusual for IBS too at the time. And so all of us met in San Francisco, Vince McGeehan, and he's in Australia, then our flight took us from San Francisco to Japan, and we were in Japan for a couple of days, and then to Vietnam. And when we got to Vietnam, we had 6 weeks orientation right in Saigon.
Where in Saigon?
It was on Kung Dae Street, in a big home that IVS had been loaned through USAID.
Speaking of USAID, did you know that IVS was a funded project by USAID?
I hadn't a clue. And actually, at the time, it really didn't matter to me. You know, when you, I lived in Arabia and we lived on a compound. It wasn't a military compound, it was a company compound. Mm-hmm. And also, lifestyles for people at that time in the early 60s. USAID was no problem. The people that they introduced us to in the education department that had worked with the Vietnamese Department of Education, they were really well-educated people. I felt that they cared about the Vietnamese people at the time, and I didn't see USAID as being a problem. You also have to realize, even though I was an international relations major, I had no opinion about the Vietnamese War. I had nothing. I was going to Vietnam to teach English. I was really focused on being a good teacher, getting to know the Vietnamese people, and really, you know, being a contribution in their education process.
And when did you actually arrive in Vietnam?
It was in July, and
I 1962.
I can't really tell you the exact date. As a matter of fact, that's kind of fuzzy in my own mind. But it was probably around the 12th of July. And then we were in Saigon for this first 6 weeks with our orientation. And we studied Vietnamese 6 hours a day. Mm-hmm. And my teacher was Bui Zum Chi. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I had so much respect for him. And we learned so much. And the atmosphere was so positive. And again, you know, this USAID thing, it was fine. I didn't see any problem with staying in a USAID house and I was very comfortable.
It just, technically, it was USOM then, wasn't it? You hadn't started.
Right.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. It was USOM.
USOM.
Mm-hmm. USOM. And Overseas Mission. Mm-hmm. And, I didn't have any hang-ups with that whatsoever.
And you mentioned that the instruction you got was very positive, the atmosphere was very positive.
Oh, yes. Done by Vietnamese, mm-hmm. Culture, and they invited Vietnamese, who spoke English very well, to come in and teach us about the culture, teach us about things to do, not to do, the religion, about Buddhism, and Catholicism, of course, was not as foreign to us as the Buddhism, but there were a lot of times when we really needed assistance in the culture. And I just saw, and even to this day, I saw myself as absorbing and being so curious and interested. Also, when I arrived in Vietnam, compared to living on the desert in Saudi Arabia, it was this beautiful, green, lush, gorgeous country, and I just fell in love with the country right away.
I suppose it would have seemed cool to you?
Well, no, it was...
Certainly humid.
No, yeah. Where I lived in Vietnam, I mean in Saudi Arabia, it was, like 99% humidity. I was on the Persian Gulf side, and it was very humid. I happen to love hot weather, so it was wonderful to me. So we had our orientation, and Don Luce, who was the head of IDS at the time.
In Vietnam.
Observed how we were getting along together and had to make these decisions to place us in the villages, etc. And they placed me with Betty Bell, and we went to Quy Nhơn. Quy Nhơn's on the coast in central Vietnam, a little fishing village. So
a place of beautiful beaches.
Oh, it was lovely.
And scenery.
Yeah, it was really, really wonderful. And they decided to put Betty in the junior high school program, and they placed me in the normal schools, which is what we used to have normal schools, we called them here in the United States, and it was to prepare students to be teachers and principals. So, and this was the first year of that school as well, and it had been built by Southern Illinois University and USOM funds. So, I had this wonderful facility with fans, et cetera. I mean, I never expected that when I went and volunteered to go to Vietnam. Also, never expected to have a roommate. I was very surprised that they decided to put us together. And that was a new experience for me because I had not had roommates before. And but Betty and I really got along very well, and what she didn't think of, I thought of. It was wonderful. I feel very privileged, that we turned out to be roommates with IDS. I mean, the whole experience has been very positive in my life. So I feel like I'm jumping around here. But school didn't start right away in Quy Nhơn, and we had a few weeks, and IVS had found a house for us after, I think, 3 weeks. We lived in a hotel at the time, which was the room the size of, I'm trying to equivalent it. If you've ever been on a ship on a cruise, it's the size of that, where two twin beds could fit side by side. And we had our luggage, etc. in this little room. And so Betty and I immediately, crack of dawn, and get up and go down to the beach. And the IVSers in agriculture in Quy Nhơn had jeeps and etc. But they really were not very pleased about us coming to town, and they felt that maybe they'd have to take care of us. So we didn't really have transportation to get around, even though Quy Nhơn isn't that big. Mm-hmm. We still needed, and I needed some way to get out to school back and forth, but IVS got us bicycles. And that was the first bike I'd ever been on that had a handbrake, and I learned not to pedal backwards to stop the bike. So we'd get up and get out to the beach and get around and meet townspeople, get to the other teachers. Teachers were wonderful and very, very friendly and clean young. So,
you're able to keep in touch with those teachers that you work with?
I have some of them. Mm-hmm. And there was one family that lived across the street from us in Queen Anne, and they had 12 children. And I taught three of them, plus the father, in the evening. Betty and I had community classes, and so we had Mr. Luan and a doctor.
L-O-A-N.
Uh-huh.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. That's
Chinese,
okay, because, well, no, there is a UAN in Vietnamese as well. And Luan, it's Luan, and one's Luan. Mm-hmm. So I've kept in touch with him, and they are now, he's in the United States. Mm-hmm. And
is he a relative of the general?
No, mm-hmm. no, Vo Quang Luan mm-hmm. is his name. And when I went to my big conference last year at TESOL, it was in Atlanta.
That's
Orlando.
That was teaching
of English as a
second language.
Uh-huh. It was in Orlando. Mm-hmm. And I arranged to see one of the sons. I see the father all the time mm-hmm. over here. I go and visit him for TET, etc. And anyway, I saw the one son that I had taught and while I was in Florida. And I went to a Queen Anne high school reunion, so I even got to meet some of the former teachers, former students. One student in Betty's class was a doctor now, and so he's telling me the story. One day he was in Betty's class, and Betty said, if you could go any place in the United States, where would you go? Because she, you know, was trying to get a practice in English, and he raised his hand, Florida! And here he is, a doctor in Florida. He just wanted to, you know, have a quick answer, Florida. And here, so I gave him Betty's phone number, and they called her. And yeah, I keep in touch with the Vietnamese. And when I went to Vietnam, I went back last summer. I stayed with Vietnamese family. I have very close friends, you know, from that experience.
Well, it's a little bit unusual because of the unpleasantness at the end of the war. A lot
right.
of people lost touch.
Right.
And it's interesting. Mm. It's often a struggle to try to find an appropriate way to
right.
maintain those relationships. And it helps to
well,
be in California. There's no question about
well,
that.
One thing that I've omitted in this story is that...
Aha! We're squeezing out the really relevant things.
You're getting to me now. Probably after the first week that I was in Saigon, I fell in love with this wonderful Vietnamese man. And that's one of the reasons that I kept in touch with Vietnamese, is because everybody knew us. And actually, in fact, we planned to marry. And, mm-hmm. and because of the war, we didn't marry. And I just felt really close to Vietnamese people. And in addition to the relationship with Nguyen Hy Vân, who was the leader of the Vietnamese volunteer group in Vietnam.
Right.
And IBSers worked with him a great deal.
Could you spell his name out for the table?
Nguyen is N-G-U-Y-E-N, a popular family name, and he, H-Y, and then Vân, V-A-N. So anyway, because of our relationship, I really spent all my holidays and all my time with Vietnamese people. And those ties are really strong. And people knew us together. And people, even now, when they see me, like Mr. Luan, they remember his family. I feel just, you know, my experience was probably very different. Even though, as time went on, and I went back to Vietnam, I stayed over past my contract with IVS. Mm-hmm. I came back to the United States and didn't want to stay in the United States, so I went back and volunteered again. So I spent almost 5 years with IBS mm-hmm. in Vietnam. But I left in 67, and I know that there were a lot of major changes after 67 in terms of contacts and people in politics. So, yeah, as a matter of fact, you know, Vietnamese ties, I just went to France and I saw a relative of one of my Vietnamese friends. And whenever I, just today I talked to two Vietnamese friends that were my friends in Vietnam. I mean, I just feel very close to the culture. In fact, it's taken me a little while, probably the other way, to let things go from Vietnam and get on with my life. It took me a long time to do that in the United States. It took me at least 10 years to come back and acculturate.
Well, when you think about it, you spent about 15-20% of your life up to that
point
with that experience.
Right,
so when it came to a physical end, it's still most of your life.
Right, so, yeah. And then, of course, in 76, when the refugees started coming, I started working with an Indo-Chinese project here in Southern California, and so I really immersed myself in the culture.
I have photographs of you swimming. I want you to know that.
Oh,
Ladies' Day at the beach.
Oh, yes, Queen Anne.
Yes, and I know you did things other than teach every day.
Yeah.
What was the pattern of your teaching like at the normal school?
We had a break in the afternoon, so I'd come home. And in the morning, I'd either go out with the principal with his Jeep, we'd carpool, or I'd ride my bike, or I'd take a ciclo, because it was quite a ways out from the town. And then I'd come back in the afternoon. Now, a major thing that I haven't mentioned at all was while we were in Saigon, before we were assigned to Quy Nhơn, we found a woman that was willing and wanted to travel to Quy Nhơn and live with us, and she was our cook and housekeeper, but more than anything else, she was really my close friend, and I learned so much. That's the other reason I feel so close to the culture.
Would she cook for you and Billy?
Betty?
Mm-hmm. Betty.
I'm Billy, yeah.
Billy?
Oh, she cooked for everybody. She cooked for Fred.
Uh-huh.
You've met Fred, Betty's husband.
Yes.
They met in Quy Nhơn.
Oh, yes.
We were so isolated, and the guys in the military base were just great about getting us. Actually, we even got some of our mail through them, as well as the local Vietnamese post office. So, Baba, and she decided who should be in our house and who shouldn't. I mean, this woman was wonderful, Buddhist, and to this day, I just love the evenings when I think of her playing her Buddhist bells, and every evening, that was a very important part of our day. So, wonderful woman. So I'd get up and go to school in the morning. School started probably around 9 o'clock, and then we'd leave around 11:30-ish, and then we'd go back at 2, from 2 to 4:30.
And what were your actual duties? What did you do in the classroom?
I taught English as a second language, and the program was always something we worked harder to change, and it was minimal, and the students, sometimes I'd only see students twice a week for 1 hour, and I'd always try and arrange so we'd get the students to be able to come longer. I also got an English club, so the students that wanted to could come and study more. And I taught probably within a week, I taught something like 350 students, and my classes were probably around 40 in a class. And some of the students had English as their third language. French was their first language, but they were required to study English, so their attitude was not wonderful. They really weren't interested in learning English. Some of them really wanted to learn English and were motivated, and there were other, I had counterpart teachers, Vietnamese ESL teachers, and I worked with them. And so attitudes varied as to whether or not, you know, English was important in their life. And sometimes the war in the later years, the war bothered, because school was so far out of town, and sometimes the security wasn't good for them to get to school.
So they wouldn't come?
Well, they would come, but, you know, I mean, we had incidences of students being shot while they were on their way to school, so that was just, you know, a horrible thing.
Why would that happen, do you think?
Well, because they got caught in crossfire while they were coming. Mm-hmm. The majority of the students that were in Queen Anne were living in dormitories, mm-hmm. so they didn't have very far to go. Mm-hmm. But, and also the war was changing so rapidly that, you know, what was a safe place from a little village to walk to school or to bike to school or would change. So that would be why that would happen. I was teaching in Queen Anne when Kennedy was assassinated, and that's one of the days I remember very well, and the support I had from some of the students.
What did they think about the assassination?
Well, one of the students who was a pro-communist, and that never bothered me in my classroom. You know, everybody was, they were enrolled in my school, that's who came to my class, tried to push a political point about Kennedy that day. Mm-hmm. And of course, I was wearing sunglasses, so nobody saw.
Let's give it a 10-second run-up. Side two, speaking with Billie Lee Langley. She was talking about a student, a pro-communist student in her classroom on the day JFK
was assassinated. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so I didn't feel like one, it wasn't appropriate to talk about politics in the classroom, and secondly, I was not in any state to be discussing something like that rationally. And so anyway, the students just told the student not to talk about that, and we went on with our day. And but the students, I felt, really were concerned about my country and how I was feeling, because by then I was certainly part of their community. So anyway, I tried to develop English clubs and ways so that they could practice English more. And then on the weekends, I took the students hiking and fishing, or we played badminton, and there was a leopard colony, I think like 7 miles away, and we walked up there, and I think it was in Quila, and I tried to find social ways of interacting with the students so that they could practice their English. Yeah.
Did you have many students that you had? You taught class at night to a club?
No, I taught the townspeople at night, mm-hmm. and they were all professional people. Mm-hmm. And they actually, that was really helpful, because that was a way for me to get to know the community, and they were very good at telling Betty and I what was going on in the community and inviting us to things, and it was.
What was going on in the community?
Oh, you know, we'd have these big theater presentations, Kai Lung, and you know, that would be a big event in our community. And our wedding, we went to a lot of weddings, or just educational meetings, or maybe the province chief would be having a gathering, and they'd invite us for that. We also had a big, I don't know, they called it a camp, but it wasn't a camp. We had a huge stadium in Queen Anne, and the schools every year would do they build these pavilions and have all kinds of scout activities in the stadium. So we always were included in that type of activity in the town.
Well, not to be indelicate, but
yes.
Did you have any projects with Nguyen in Saigon with his group? With those?
Oh, yeah, sure. We. Whenever I could get to Saigon, when they were having a work weekend, mm-hmm. we'd go out, we painted schools, and, you know, we just, whatever needed to be done in the village, we'd have these work weekends. Mm-hmm. And so we did a lot with the voluntary group there. Mm-hmm. And
what was his official title?
He was the director of the Vietnamese Voluntary Association.
He's the Vietnamese Voluntary Association, mm-hmm. so it's like the mm-hmm. IVS, but
right,
but
right.
in-country Peace Corps.
John Summer, Don Luce, all the guys right. worked with him. Right. They knew his group mm-hmm. real well. And Bao, Chong Nap Bao, was, who's in Switzerland now, who I'm always in touch with and go to see when I can in Europe, he was the assistant. A lot of these people are really good friends. I mean, the Nguyen Viet, the gentleman that's working with the Vietnamese local newspaper, mm-hmm. he was one of the volunteers. And so we a lot of our contacts were through these wonderful people. Mm-hmm. So, and back to Queen Yun, mm. A normal school also was funded through Southern Illinois University. So they sent professors to give workshops and to work with the teachers at the normal schools. And the Queen Yun Normal School had Dr. Darnell, Donald Darnell, who is from SIU. And so we also became very good friends. And it's somebody that I kept in touch with.
He's still alive?
Yeah. Hmm. As a matter of fact, I just got a card from him.
Does he live in Carbondale?
And he is retired mm-hmm. and lives outside of Carbondale, and he has married a Vietnamese who was the wife of his interpreter who was killed. She wants to move to Los Angeles. She has a brother and, you know, friends here, but he's originally Canadian, comes from a very large family, and likes Illinois, I mean,
yeah.
like in...
Southern Illinois.
Right, Southern Illinois, mm-hmm. yeah. So, I don't know, but that was his latest note.
Well, the irony, my first teaching job, yeah. well, first serious teaching job was mm-hmm. at Illinois State, which was the normal.
Uh-huh.
In normal.
Yes.
That's right. So.
Yeah, well... Actually, when I applied to Elmira, I applied to Ypsilanti, which was a normal school. And Don Darnell was very helpful with the communications between the administration of my normal school and myself. There was often a big gap, and our goals were not often the same thing. And, I took my job really seriously. In the summer, of course, there was no school, so I'd get projects going with IVS or whatever. And one of my first projects was to establish the Dewey Decimal System with a library at our school. So I got two other teachers to work with me. So we stamped the books, got them all carded and coded and out of the locked cupboards and ready to go for the new school year. And we got a new principal, and he came and put all the books back into a cupboard and locked them behind glass doors. So sometimes it was very hard, you know, to get these common goals. I was in IVS and in Queen Yun probably a little over a year, about a year and a half, and because we were the first education team, IVS struggled a great deal, also because we were the first women, other than the nurses that had come in the early 50s and had been gone for a long time. IVS really wasn't accustomed to having women in the team. So anyway, after a lot of discussion and encouraging, we decided that we would have a specialist in each team, like a specialist for the education team, specialist for the community development team, specialist for the agriculture team. And they asked me to become the specialist for the education team. So I organized workshops and orientation for new teachers. And then eventually I was a substitute for a while and was the leader for the education team. And that meant I had to go to Saigon, and I really wanted to stay one in the classroom mm-hmm. and two. But the philosophy for IVS at the time, you had to realize how new the education team was, mm-hmm. and there was a lot of conflict as to the issue of if you spoke English, you naturally could teach English. And that was not my philosophy, and I really felt that we wouldn't do justice to our students if we continued with that philosophy. So it was good. I became the education specialist, and after I left, others followed, and they maintained that position in the IVS organization. And then when I came back the second time for my second term, they placed me in Saigon, and within a short time I became the director of the education team. I really wanted to stay in the classroom, and I got to go to the normal school in Saigon, and I got to teach there for a year. Mm-hmm. But there were major changes with by then USAID. I didn't like working in the office, for one thing. It kind of reminded me of that original, yes, you'd make a good secretary. Mm-hmm. And I really enjoyed the students so much. So consequently, if I was doing that, a lot of times I had more classes in my home in Saigon. That's when I started to teach classes, like the Buddhist organization, and those are really long-time friends. I mean, the Buddhist organization, people from that just, you know, I've not lost touch with them. And mm-hmm. even though we don't see each other all the time or whatever, we still know each other. Mm-hmm. And I became the director of the education team, and that's how Anne got to know me, because I had to establish communities where our new teachers would be placed, mm-hmm. and also I had to observe the volunteers when they were teaching, or you know, troubleshoot, whatever the case may be. So I was flying literally all over the place and visiting teachers. And
did you eventually, when what I loved to, from your perspective, because mm-hmm. you would know more than anyone else, I'm always curious as to how much training in teaching English as a second language volunteers got.
Right.
From the beginning, obviously, there's none.
Right.
Okay, we know that. But then I think there was some TESOL training in Vietnam when they got
yes.
there.
Uh-huh.
And then, did they ever have it in Washington before they came out? I mean, not in Washington, but I mean in Hunters
yeah,
Ferry or someplace where they... did it get more sophisticated, or did it plateau out?
After I... left Vietnam in 67 after I, you know, terminated my IVS experience, I took part in a couple of orientations in D.C. Mm-hmm. And one of them we did. They had TESOL training with, I can't remember the name of it, but there at that point there was a large center in Washington, mm-hmm. and they were equipped to give that type of orientation, equipped in the sense of that they even knew about Southeast Asia at that point. That must have been in 68 that I did those two, and I was very much interested in that because. As time went on, it became more obvious that our volunteers were so frustrated, the classes were so big, mm-hmm. and they had teaching training, a lot of them had teaching training, but just nothing in terms of English as a second language. Mm-hmm. And actually, at that point, it was quite new. Mm-hmm. Now, my goodness, books are just rampant.
No.
I mean, it's incredible how from 1961, where we had two textbooks, to now, I mean, it's incredible how the field has expanded, and I get really excited about it. No, the teachers had, getting back to the issue, the teachers had very little training. Some of them were not teachers that came, and I'm divided on that issue in terms of, can a person be a good volunteer without having this expertise behind them? As a matter of fact, that was one of the issues that I felt big differences with IVS and myself in later years. I don't see it as being an either-or issue. I've seen volunteers that had no teaching experience, that got their language experience, mm-hmm. Vietnamese, cultural experience, jumped in, and they were incredible teachers mm-hmm. in Vietnam. And really good. And they had a good experience. And not to say that it, you know, there are bumps no mm-hmm. matter what. Teaching, I think, is any job is like that. But I've also seen teachers that had background and training that arrived and they went home within a short time because it didn't meet their expectations.
You met IVS volunteers who left Vietnam and went home because it didn't meet their expectations?
Meet their expectations,
Now, who could those have been?
I haven't a clue.
Well, perhaps they haven't returned their forms.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't met any of those people.
Right,
yes.
Right. So, you know, that's an interesting issue.
Mm-hmm.
Whether or not that should be a prerequisite.
Well, your difference in later years arose from the fact that they were setting experts as opposed to just volunteers, or?
No, my difference was with IVS was that the professional part was the way they would consider an applicant.
Yes, that's what I meant.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. But this is at post-war you're talking about.
Yeah.
And the, well, did you, were you active in setting up the TESOL program in Saigon so volunteers would come in and go to a program?
Oh, yes.
How long was that program? Oh, look, I'm getting ahead of myself.
You mean
when,
like,
did that start?
When did we start?
Yeah.
We had it when I came in 62.
That's right. You had it from Vietnamese.
And Yusong.
Yusong, okay.
Dr. Allardyce.
Okay.
Allardyce.
Allardyce, yes.
Wonderful yeah. woman. And Potts, Dr. Potts. I don't think I can remember.
So there was always TESOL training
mm-hmm.
for volunteers when they got in.
Oh, yes.
And it lasted about 6 weeks?
Well, yeah, but that was minimal. You know, mm-hmm. probably we'd have like 3 sessions.
Mm-hmm.
But we were always having workshops.
Right.
We were always having conferences. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've got pictures of me standing around, like, you know, teaching at these things.
Oh, yes, I've seen
know.
Them. Yes.
So,
she has them too.
Right.
Yes.
Well, you know. Glorious moments of our career.
To June, who has brought out her album.
And you know, and
I
wrote materials, and we all just got really creative. And I'm still not convinced that someone with TESOL training is always going to be your best.
Mm-hmm.
For one thing, we just had so many things that you had to adjust to. I mean, the schedule. The school schedule, how many students you'd have in the room, whether school was on that day or not, a lot of holidays. You know, somebody who comes in, well, this is how we're going to do, doesn't quite work like that. I think I remember the first week you have to bend like the bamboo. I think that there's a lot to be said about enthusiasm and someone who can adjust easily to change.
Now you said you were there almost 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
You were at you worked your first station for two years.
Uh-huh.
And
a little over 2 years.
And then
yeah.
what happened?
Then I came to Saigon for a while.
Mm-hmm. Well, how did run that through emotionally?
That was
how did you feel at the end of those 2 years?
How did I feel at the end of those 2 years? Well, let me see. Of course, I'm thinking about, I was planning an incredible trip. That's how I felt.
The trip home?
Yeah,
yes.
The trip home. I got to, that's when I got to go to Burma.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I planned all kinds of wonderful things. With an IVSer, I went with Marilyn Pallies.
Mm-hmm.
I hope somebody interviews her.
Let me write her name down.
Yeah.
Maybe we'll see if we can find her. How do you spell her last name?
She's McDougal now. M-C.
Oh, that name. No, that
M-A-C.
Hold on a second. Let me get my page back. Go ahead.
Marilyn McDougal, but her name
her
at
name
that time was Pallies.
P-A-L-L-Y-S. Y-S.
Uh-huh.
And it's now
McDougal. M-A-C.
D-O-U-G-A-L-L. Right. And where do you think she lives these days?
Oh, she's in. She's outside of Worcester, Massachusetts. Yeah. Her husband teaches at Lowell, Mass.
Do you know her husband's name?
What's the, yeah, John.
John.
He knows Don.
because we'll be in Hartford.
Oh, yeah.
Shortly, and.
Well, Marilyn was one. She was in the second group. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if she came right before Ann or. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think she did.
Well, so the, where we were talking about that.
Oh, the adjustment. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I was so frustrated about the education team because there was so much emphasis on the agriculture team, and versus the education team. Mm-hmm. There wasn't a lot of understanding at times, and I'm not sure why, you know, exactly what all that means. But, and some of it had to do with there was just so much to do, and you only have time to do so much. Anyway, so I looked at it as an opportunity to get to Saigon and maybe help with the new volunteers that were coming and the orientation and also give more emphasis to the education team. So I felt that it was a good cause that way. But I, in terms of getting out of the classroom, my love has always been in the classroom.
Actually, what I was referring to the fact that your 2 years, your contract is up.
Uh-huh.
And you decide to...
Extend.
Extend. In country.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Forget the trip to...
No, I
take
just...
the trip anyway.
Oh, no. What I did was I figured out I'll extend and take the trip later.
Oh, okay.
Because Marilyn came later.
To go with you.
Yeah, I mean, so she could... Yeah. So it was no
hardship. Went back to Saigon. You worked as a...
I worked in the office.
In the office as a specialist.
As
a, now for uh-huh, the education.
Right. Okay. And then the education team leader left, and I took their...
Who was that? Do you remember who
the... You know, I honestly don't remember, but it might have been Clark... No, Clark Davis.
And you worked at that for another 2 years?
No, I only stayed there for a few months. I think it was like 9 months or something.
Mm-hmm. And then?
And then I came... Then I took my trip... Mm-hmm. Then I came to the United States. Mm-hmm. I stayed a few months, and then I went back to Vietnam with IVS.
You left in the middle of a contract?
No.
That's what
I extended.
Oh, you extended a year.
Not a year.
Yeah.
I just extended.
Extended that period of time.
I extended,
okay.
Right.
I
got
it.
Okay. Right.
And because your draft board wouldn't care about this, fortunately.
No.
Let's go over the circumstances of why you decided to go back.
Well... I was in love with Vaughn, and I just could not imagine living in a little town in Northern California, and also I couldn't imagine living in the United States. Mm-hmm. It's just, the acculturation was just too much for me. Mm-hmm. And I just loved Vietnam. I felt so at home in Vietnam.
Well, what was this? This is the United States was now, this is like 1964?
Yeah, 64. And actually, Vaughn even came for Christmas that year. He met my family.
Well, 61 to 64 didn't look that much different to me. But what did you see? How were you feeling about that adjustment process?
It's very personal. It's a very personal thing. Uh-huh. I had lived out of the United States.
Right.
You see, no, I don't mean just 62. I'd been living in Arabia before.
That's what
so,
I wanted to
see,
get
this
at.
Gap is right. Like humongous.
Exactly.
Plus, my family was finally getting to know me for the first time. That can be scary. And so job. Nobody wanted to give me a job. Mm-hmm. My experience was nothing.
And you didn't have the right degrees.
I didn't have the right degrees. And I did some substitute teaching. You know, I kind of looked around to see what I might want to do. Mm-hmm. I felt like... adjusting to my country, getting a job, and why do that when I knew where I could go and be mm-hmm. useful? Mm-hmm. And that's what I did. I was ironing one day, and mm-hmm. I said, this is, and I liked to iron, by the way. It had nothing to do with ironing. Uh-huh. That's when I think.
Right.
When
it's
I do
zen,
dishes.
It's zen ironing.
When I do dishes, mm-hmm. Thich Nhat Hanh. Mm-hmm. do dishes.
That is a reference to a very famous Vietnamese Buddhist monk and philosopher.
Okay. And, okay. Ironing. So I wrote and I said, I'd like to come back. They said, we have a position at the Saigon Normal School. Mm-hmm. So fine, I'd live in Saigon, also be near Vaughn that way. Mm-hmm. And I had really not wanted to live in Saigon. I mean, living in the provinces was much, much better as far as I was concerned. But that was the easiest adjustment. And then I became a team leader. Mm-hmm.
You shoulder those responsibilities for the next 2 years.
Right. And then I extend it again a little bit. So.
Well, why did you leave?
Then I was at the point where my counterparts, the teachers, and other people I was working with were so well educated and had their masters and their doctorates in TESOL or English. And I felt that if I wanted to live in the country, that it would only be respectful for me to come back and get my master's and my doctorate. Hmm. So Vaughn was getting his in architecture, and we were both finishing up, you know, and so I came back with the goal of getting my education degree. And that's how that happened.
Vaughn was going to school
in Saigon.
In Saigon, right. Mm-hmm. And then, so you finished it, you got your master's in...
No, I came back, and it was really a challenge to find a school, and I wanted to write my... I wanted a small school, for one thing, and that was hard. I mean, everything is... When you adjust and you come back to a country.
Yeah.
Have you ever lived in another country?
Oh, yeah.
You know,
just the way people walk on the sidewalk is just tremendously irritating.
Well, I knew that I could be somewhat sheltered by coming to Gardena, California, because of the Japanese-American community. And by then, I'd studied Ikebana, and I was getting serenity from that, and I immediately got into a class in Gardena, a Japanese home with my tatami and my, you know, I did that. And then I found a college after Santa Barbara, UCLA, and all this other stuff. And I could tell right away I was going to have trouble in the education departments. I found this little school called Dominguez Hills.
And Hills. Cal State Dominguez Hills is what it became?
It was an apartment house.
Mm-hmm. Cal State Dominguez Hills was an apartment house?
Yes!
Perfect for you.
You got it. You got it. Right. And these incredible professors. Oh, so bright and so wonderful. It was like going back to Switzerland again. Mm-hmm. And they knew what I was talking about. And I wanted to do something like contrastive analysis and Vietnamese sounds with English, you know, for my doctorate. And wonderful woman, Filipino, UCLA woman, and she helped me out. I got my teaching credential, and while I'm doing this, I'm trying to earn a little money, and so I started teaching in Compton in the Black community because I knew that I needed at this time to do something for my own country. You know, it's like it was time to do and give back.
Mm-hmm.
And I did that for 7 years, and that was a terrible experience because I'm walking around and talking about my wonderful experience in Vietnam, and these people are having their relatives killed there.
Mm-hmm.
I did not know this.
Compton, of course, that's Compton, which is essentially south of Watts, but it's one of the more troubled areas of Los Angeles. And
it's
that's
the Black community when I was there.
Exactly. But it's also a time of increasing social tension that led to the riots.
Absolutely. Right. Absolutely. You know, 68 right there. And so what happened was I was volunteering for the college in over in Compton, and the Mexican community started increasing over there. So I was teaching, and people were hearing what was going on, and they got me into the classroom. They just said, you, and I love the kids. I really had wonderful experiences with the kids, but I was a failure in terms of integration for my life. It's the first time in my life, you know, that I really wasn't accepted. So then I went and while I was in college, you know, no mas, I decided to start working in elementary schools with children and language acquisition. I decided that would be easier for people to understand for my thesis. That's why I had that experience with the tape recorders. And so I did word association with children in the LA Unified School District. And I loved working with the children. I just really, it was a good experience for me. So I knew I would be okay in education. And eventually it evolved, and all these years kept passing. I kept working on my doctorate. And then when it came time for me to write at Dominguez. We were in the process of, is education really a science or not? And human beings, and I left. I just could not, I had no energy. I could not argue with people over this kind of an issue. And at that time, Dominguez began growing, and it's now a huge campus, gorgeous campus. And I still have very good memories. And they, you know, I got this very good degree and a lot of experience.
Was it a master's in?
No, I never finished my master's. Mm-hmm. I did all my paperwork. I did absolutely everything. Mm-hmm. When it came down for people to read, I could get people to read it that would, you know, would understand. By then, I decided to do the contrastive analysis between Vietnamese and English. And a lot of people just, they just couldn't. Maybe it was the issue, maybe it was Vietnam, I don't know what it was. It didn't matter. And then the Vietnamese came and I started working for the Indo-Chinese Project. Mm-hmm. And that's, I got out.
Indo-Chinese Project, John McAuliffe?
No, Indo-Chinese Project was with the LA Unified School
District. Okay.
They had a contract with them. Mm-hmm. Carol Porter, who June Pulcini knew in Laos, a woman with no experience except having lived in Laos, but no experience as a headed the program. It was very interesting. So I worked with them for 10 years, maybe a little over 10 years. That started in 76. But what I was able to do in the meantime was I was able to develop a career and become professional and not compromise so much that I felt like I wasn't using my, you know, my background. So I got into the Indo-Chinese Project and seriously did ESL. And
for Vietnamese immigrants?
Yeah, and Hmong and Cambodian. It expanded into the whole gamut of the refugees that were coming. And I learned a lot because, you know, each culture is so very different. And, excuse me.
Hold on one second.
Yeah.
How are we doing? Oh, we're doing fine. So you worked for 10 years with the...
Indo-Chinese, yeah, Indo-Chinese. And that was good. That was very good. But also, in the middle of going to school and working on my goals of getting my degree, which I did get my teaching credential, which was wonderful, because that has really helped me out in a career, I also...